So, good morning, everyone. And Happy New Year to those who are here for the first time in the new year. And some of you were here New Year's Eve, along with a great crowd, to start the new year. So I thought this morning we'd start with a Zen koan, one of those old Zen teaching stories, which are typically a dialogue between, most often a dialogue between an old Chinese Zen master from the Tang Dynasty and one of his disciples. And I say he because the majority of them are men, but there are koans featuring women as well, and we've had some fun with those in the past year or so. Some of them are being rediscovered. But this one is a koan featuring Dongshan, who was one of, along with his student, Zaoshan, were the founders of our lineage of Zen, of Soto or Zaodong Zen in China. And there are some wonderful koans about him. In this one, he's sick. He's not feeling well. And a monk comes to him and says, "You're ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" And Dongshan says, "Yes, there is." Then the monk asks, "Does the one who is not ill take care of you?" And Dongshan answers, "I have the opportunity to take care of him." The monk then asks, "How is it when you take care of him?" Now, in one translation, Dongshan says, "Then I don't see that he has any illness." And in another translation, Dongshan says, "At that time, I don't see the sickness. At that time, I don't see the sickness." I like the second one a little better, I think, because I think it's closer probably to the Chinese, because the Chinese probably doesn't say, it probably just says, "don't see illness," rather than "his illness" or "my illness," or it probably doesn't specify. So I like the ambiguity of the second translation. "At that time, I don't see illness." So the monk asks, "Is there anyone who does not get ill?" Dongshan says, "Yes, there is." The monk asks, "Does the one who is not ill take care of you?" Dongshan says, "I have the opportunity to take care of him." Monk says, "How is it when you take care of him?" Dongshan says, "At that time, I don't see illness." So this koan reminds me of a quote. How many of you have heard of Stephen Levine or Levine? He's taught for decades and worked with death and dying and written many books on the subject. And there's a quote that really meant so much to me years ago after I'd spent a lot of time with a close family member who died. And I've looked and looked for that quote, and I just can't find it. So I'm just going to paraphrase it. And it goes something like this. When you sit with someone who's dying day after day, breathing in and out together, after a while, you're not sure anymore who is ill and who is healthy, who is dying and who is living. Who is the caregiver? Who is the receiver? In the words of a wonderful line from our Zen meal chant, "You realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift." And by emptiness, it means the non-separateness, the complete interconnection between giver, receiver, and gift. In the introduction to this koan, there's a commentary by another Zen master named Wansong. And he asks, when the physical elements are out of tune, how does one attend and nurture? When you're ill, is there a not ill person that cares for you? Is there a way that being ill gives you an opportunity to care for the one who cares for you? When you are ill, is there also a not ill you? Who cares for whom? In the moment of full caring presence, does illness vanish, as Stephen Levine describes? We can probe this koan from both the perspective of our relative everyday lives, where we have illness and health, good and bad. But we can also probe the koan from the absolute perspective of non-duality. Which we'll talk about in a bit. Delusion, or self-clinging, in Buddhism is often referred to as illness, and the Buddha as the great physician, the great healer of that delusion. Is any of us free of delusion? Probably not anyone here. And yet, in any moment of full presence, full awareness, awakening, when self and other, self and the inside and outside drops away, we don't see illness. We don't see illness and health. Wansong says, this is where everyday practice empowers you when you're dying. This is where everyday practice empowers you when you're dying, and I would add, when you're dealing with sickness or aging, debility. So the reason I'm talking about this is that I've been reflecting a lot on sickness and old age lately, after spending 10 days with my elderly parents over Christmas. It's not that they're particularly sick. They're remarkably healthy for 91 and 89. But as my mother Riley says, the age is upon us. That's an expression I think she got from Mr. Neff, who was a very elderly Mennonite neighbor of theirs in the rural, in the countryside outside Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where they've lived for the past 30 years. Or 20, plus another 10. My mother's always liked old people. For years, she delivered Meals on Wheels, and she had an array of different old folks that she liked to visit. But she's finding it hard to be an old person herself, receiving help from others, unable to do the things that gave her life meaning for decades. Unable to cook and bake, that's hard for her. 10 years ago, they moved from the house, a good-sized house on a big, with a big yard and a vegetable garden, large garden, to a retirement community. And the part that they live in is looks like a tidy little subdivision with brick duplexes and tree-lined streets. It doesn't even really look like a retirement community. But, you know, two-car garages, little lampposts. But she didn't adjust well. She felt isolated. She missed her old neighbors. No children dropped in to see her collection of dollhouse miniatures. And she'd stopped volunteering at the local library when they computerized their systems. She wasn't quick to make new friends. in a population that she felt was more educated than she. My mom is kind of a classist, an inverted classist. She's you know, pretty cautious about people she feels, you know, are college educated. And she's not. In fact, she's always been really smart and funny, and everybody likes her. But she's had that always with her. So about 6 years ago, she had compression fractures from in her spine from osteoporosis. She's quite bent. She didn't tell me at the time. I only just found this out at the recent visit that that happened when she was lifting her sewing machine from the floor onto the dining table. I tell you this as a cautionary tale. How can we bring mindfulness to the things that we've done fairly mindlessly for years, so that we know how to adjust how we do things, you know, as we age, and when it's time to stop, when it's time to let go of that driver's license. That's what my dad is holding at bay, right? So my mom had surgery for the compression fractures, and complications led to a slow recovery. But she gradually improved. She continued to cook and bake and sew a little and do what she calls playing with paper, which means making gorgeous little origami gift boxes and bookmarks out of old calendars and folding and collating the church bulletins. That's something she's done forever. And she'd stop and lie down when her back hurt. Then a fender bender that wasn't her fault resulted in her car being written off, and my dad would not consider getting her another one. And his station wagon was too big and awkward for her to handle. She took the loss of autonomy hard. Since early in their marriage, she'd been able to drive here and there for her numerous errands and activities. It was one area where she had autonomy. Because in their marriage, my dad handled the finances and the major decisions. My mom has never even learned to use an ATM machine. It was after she stopped driving that I really noticed her short-term memory deteriorating, along with her ability to focus on tasks. She got weepy and overwhelmed at the prospect of Christmas dinner the last time we were both there, which was maybe 5 years ago, for Christmas. More and more she sounded depressed during our weekly phone calls. She had trouble sleeping and would lie awake reviewing her life. Losing both her parents in early adolescence during the Depression. Going to live with an elderly aunt and uncle who made her feel like a poor relation. Her long marriage, outwardly genial. My parents have a folksy charm and are loved by many people. But beneath the surface lies a lot of inner pain and layers of hurt, buffered by their great sense of humor that has helped them survive. Since then, over this past year, in 2013, I visited twice. So not this past year, the year before, 2013, I visited in March on the occasion of a retrospective show of my sister's fabric art. I had a sister who died in 1990, so that's a very long time ago. She was 35, of a very aggressive lymphoma. And so all these years later, we had this show of her work. And then I went back again in October for my mom's 90th birthday, and we went on a road trip to the New Jersey shore and to our old hometown, small town in New Jersey. Both times, my mom went through a lot of resistance and negativity and trepidation leading up to the event. And each time, the event itself went beautifully, and she was just embraced with the love of many friends, and particularly cousins and little grand-nephews and nieces and friends. And I think, in part as a result, over this past year, she has seemed somewhat more at peace with herself, but increasingly frail and increasingly forgetful. About 3 months ago, she had a fall, going to the washroom in the middle of the night. Fortunately, no bones were broken and there were no signs of concussion. But she was pretty disoriented and very weak. So they kept her in the nursing care wing of this retirement complex where they live for observation, and they did a very thorough assessment and concluded that she was too much at risk to go back to their house. Unfortunately, the only bed that was open was in a shared room in a unit with people with advanced dementia, nonverbal groaning. And this was pretty discouraging for her. 2 weeks later, she moved to a somewhat better unit. And then 2 weeks later, she finally moved to where she is now, a private room where she can have her own furniture. Only 12 residents, and it's what one might call the minimum security unit. Somehow, all the communication led me to believe that it was more of an assisted living situation, but it is nursing care, and the residents are the least impaired. But it came as a shock to my mom to realize that there was a keypad code at the door. She was incarcerated. When we arrived, she'd been in her room for just 2 weeks. She kept repeating the story of how she got there. Well, first I fell, and then I was in with those people who couldn't talk, and I couldn't sleep, and it was so noisy. And when they gave her first tour of where she is now, she saw so many smiling faces, she thought, yes, this is going to be much better. But then once she moved in, she realized that those smiling faces were all the staff, and that many of her cohort were actually had this kind of shocked look. They were ambulatory, but they weren't friendly. They were like her, had probably been moved there because they couldn't cope at home anymore. And they had a little bit of a shell-shocked look on their faces. She says the staff are kind and friendly, but some of the young ones talk to the residents like children, and they don't know how to cook. They don't let her use her own fish oil supplement, and theirs tastes different from hers. And the orange juice isn't like her orange juice. And even the root beer is different from her brand of root beer, although a dip of vanilla ice cream renders it acceptable. The bed's too small and is not comfortable, and the heater's too noisy, though that got fixed. It wakes her up. Why can't she try at home again? Maybe she could still make that chicken casserole for Dad and some apple brownies. He has to remind her how badly it went the last time she tried cooking, and she told him, don't let her try again. So how would you be? I ask myself this repeatedly. How would you be? How would you be faced with a sudden uprooting and change like that? What would be the hardest pill for you to swallow? I told my mom I'd probably be calling for food reinforcements. I'd probably be complaining about the non-organic yogurt pumped with sugar and gelatin, overcooked vegetables, iceberg lettuce. The food would be hard. The food would be really hard. So I'm going to bring in another koan, Zen koan, that's relevant here. This time it's not a story, it's just a quote from Zen Master Yunmen. And this is that he, from probably a Dharma talk. And he said, "Medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself?" What do you think he means? Isn't the purpose of medicine to subdue disease? But of course, it's not always successful, is it? Sometimes disease is too powerful. The chemotherapy fails. The infection resists the antibiotic. The antidepressant does more harm than good. Sometimes. But maybe the meaning here goes beyond the battle metaphor of disease as a of medicine as a weapon against disease. Maybe it's that medicine and disease are two sides of a single coin, like life and death, light and darkness, enlightenment and delusion, the relative everyday world and the absolute non-dual interconnected world. Simultaneous and mutually necessary, rather than oppositional. If we're too attached to one and too aversive to the other, we get snagged, right? We suffer. Yuan Wu, who is the commentator in this collection of koans, different one from the previous one I mentioned, says, if you cling to existence, he speaks of non-existence for you. He, meaning Yunmen, the Zen master in the koan. If you cling to existence, he speaks of non-existence for you. If you are attached to non-existence, he speaks of existence for you. If you are attached to neither existence nor non-existence, he manifests the 16-foot golden body, that's the Buddha body, for you in a pile of crap and rubbish, appearing and disappearing. And then the commentator tells another story. And this story is about Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and his disciple Sudana. One day Manjushri orders Sudana to go and pick some medicinal herbs. He says, if there is something that is not medicine, bring it back to me. So Sudana goes and he searches all over through the woods and the fields, but he could not find anything that was not medicine. So he comes back to Manjushri and says, there is nothing that is not medicine. Manjushri says, gather something that is medicine. So Sudana goes back out and comes back with a blade of grass and hands it to Manjushri. Manjushri holds up the blade of grass, shows it to the assembly, because of course there's always an assembly there, and says, this medicine can kill people and it can also bring people to life. So in Buddhist teaching, often blades of grass refer to phenomenal existence, everything that emerges in our phenomenal existence, so a blade of grass. So there are lots of koans that talk about blades of grass as the stuff, you know, the stuff that we live with. So every blade of grass in our life can kill us or bring us to life. A parking ticket, a hike in the mountains, a marriage, a job promotion, a sudden diagnosis can kill us or bring us to life, depending on how we meet it. If the whole earth is medicine, then even poison can be transformed into nourishment. This reminds me of the Tibetan Lojong teaching. We were studying them, I guess maybe it's been a couple years ago, the series of Lojong teachings, the 7-point mind training, one of which is turn all adverse circumstances into the path. Turn poison into medicine. How do we meet circumstances that thwart and limit us, like illness, accident, aging? Inevitably, will. Is there somebody who needs to come in? Our culture places a high value on individual autonomy and independence, right? A wonderful writer, Atul Gawande, who's a surgeon and a very thoughtful writer about our relationship to medicine and illness, illness and death, has a new book out called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. Highly recommended. He talks a lot about nursing homes. He comments, our reverence for independence takes no account of the reality of what happens in life. Sooner or later, independence will become impossible. Serious illness or infirmity will strike. It is as inevitable as sunset. And then a new question arises. If independence is what we live for, what do we do when it can no longer be sustained? Well, self-awareness, honesty, humility are all assets when we face contracting independence. Gawande writes about the importance of being able to have difficult conversations with our loved ones when we or they face serious illness, impairment, eventually death. We need to be able to talk about our fears, our hopes, and what we appreciate and value most about life, even in limiting circumstances. Those of you who are here, I think it was just last week, may remember the reading I did from the New York Times Magazine about a very multicultural family arguing over what to say for grace for Christmas dinner. And what they decided on was that each person, they'd go around the table and each person would say something they were grateful for, something they were fearful about, and something that they were hopeful about for the new year. That was their common ground, even though they had Muslims and Christians and atheists all represented in the family. So if we can be that open to share our fears, our hopes, and what we value most in our lives with each other, I think we'll increase our resilience and expand our capacity to stay present and kind and patient with each other through the challenges of dealing with sickness, old age, and death, and sometimes facing those incredibly difficult decisions that must be made. We need to practice asking, who am I? What is the self? When we meet challenging circumstances, especially the ones we think are medicines we don't want to swallow. Life will remind us sooner or later that all our precious preferences and habits are conditioned and provisional. And life will teach us, if we let it, who we truly are, how ultimately unbounded by circumstances we are, how we are more than our illness, our debility, or our woundedness. Now, I don't want to be glib or simplistic about this. For example, when someone's grieving acutely, it's not helpful to trot out a Zen platitude about no birth, no death. And when someone's just entering into the new reality of say, a cancer diagnosis or disability, laying the koan of the person who is not ill on them also might not be skillful. Timing is very, very important when having difficult conversations. It takes tremendous courage and patience to face these hard questions. But if we accord ourselves and each other the dignity of our wholeness and the wonder of our vastness, we can live our days fully. Letting go, breath by breath. Until one day, the time comes to let go of our lives. When I first arrived on the scene with my parents, I didn't know if my role was to advocate for my mom to go back to the house or to help her adjust to this new reality. So I decided to watch and listen and to enjoy being with her. We brought her back to the house every day, and she began to reclaim her place there, but in a different way, part-time. Kind of like kids who spend half their time with one parent and half with the other, we joked. At one point she said, "Well, you know, I guess there are things that I need that are here but not there, and things I need that are there but not here." I said, "Yeah, you got it, Mom." We packed up her small display cabinet with 5 dollhouse rooms to put in the corner of her new room for people to admire. The nurses often bring their children in to meet the residents. By the end of our visit, my mom was beginning to refer to her new room as her den rather than her cell. She has her typewriter set up there, and she is typing letters to people more than she's done in several years. She says she can concentrate better without Dad wandering around. She's getting acquainted with a couple of the other residents and developing connections with the staff. We found on a shelf in a cupboard at their house her box of inspirational stories, clippings, and quotes. Some of them with several copies that she has typed out. And she sent these to people, many, many people over the years, enclosed in letters. I've received many of them. One of her favorites is a story about an old Chinese farmer. Every day, he'd go down the path to a spring with 2 jars hanging from a shoulder yoke to gather enough water for his daily needs and for his little garden plot. But one of the jars was cracked, and every day it would leak along the way until by the time he got home, there was hardly any water left. One day his neighbor asked him, "Why do you keep using that old jar? You're wasting all that effort hauling water." And the old farmer turned and pointed back along the path. And all along the side where the cracked jar had hung was a beautiful swath of wildflowers blooming. So it's all too easy to assume when we're cracked and damaged by illness, aging, the vicissitudes of life, that our lives no longer have worth. But sometimes it's the very cracks that open up possibilities for caring and for connection, for letting go of our rigid ideas about our identity, and for opening up to a different kind of freedom than our conventional idea that freedom consists in being able to do whatever we want, whenever we want. Yuan Wu says, "When is and is not are left behind, and gain and loss are forgotten, then you are clean and naked, free and at ease." think I'll close with a poem. And this is by Erica Jong. This is from one of Stephen Levine's books called Who Dies? An Investigation of Conscious Living and Conscious Dying. So the poem is called, Is Life the Incurable Disease? Is life the incurable disease? The infant is born howling, and we laugh. The dead man smiles, and we cry. Resisting the passage, always resisting the passage that turns life into eternity. Blake sang alleluias on his deathbed. My own grandmother, hardly a poet at all, smiled as we'd never seen her smile before. Perhaps the dress of flesh is no more than a familiar garment that grows looser as one diets on death. And perhaps we discard it or give it to the poor in spirit who have not yet learned what blessing it is to go naked. So, to hope maybe a phrase or two from these old Zen stories will resonate for you, and just hold those questions with a kind of open heart and mind and see what they reveal to you as you go about your daily lives, whether you're facing something, you know, some momentous crisis, life crisis, or just in the simple bumps and hitches that we encounter in our daily lives. All those little grasses that sprout up as medicine for us. Good medicine for us. So thank you all. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for listening. Page 3 in your book.